Man 7. What happened after Summers and Payne closed down?
Well, he sold up and went to the Channel Isles to escape the taxes. He even made a packet, as I see it, during the war. Anyway, I then had a short spell at Harland and Wolff's.
That was the Isle of Wight?
No, in the docks of Southampton. Then Thornycroft's. Then after that, I was unemployed for 5 months. And I walked the streets wishing that I had never given up the possibility of having a permanent commission. Times I wished I hadn't. Anyway, I sold fountain pens from door to door for John Bull, the paper John Bull. And after a period of approximately five months, I got information that the Supermarine Aviation Works, as it was known then, required a boat builder loftsman with general aeronautical experience. There were many applications for the job, but if I could get on the interviewing list, it appeared I had the qualifications. I achieved this through a friend, but he couldn't do any more than get me the interview. And I got the job. And I remained from 1922, the 13th of June 1922, with the Supermarine and Vickers Supermarine until I retired in 1961. I started at the Supermarine, engaged on the building and the modification of all types of Supermarine flying boats, including prototype wooden Seagull, Southampton and Seamews. On the 12th of August 1926, I was transferred by Commander Byrd and Reginald Mitchell, the chief designer, to his inspection staff. Under Mr. D. MacFarlane, chief inspector. Now, Commander Byrd asked me to go to Mitchell's office after lunch for an interview, the rates of pay and so on. And all I was there, and although I was working piecework and earning just under £6 a week, plus every so many weeks a £20 bonus, all that Mitchell could offer me on the inspection staff was £4 a week. But it was a 9 o'clock job. I also lost time the third overtime and worked for no pay overtime because it was a staff job. But as he said, you'll have to get out of the rut again. And I, after consideration and talking it over with my wife, who, by the way, was Miss Snow, who I previously spoke about. She was Miss Snow of Torquay. We talked it over. I accepted the job. This was in 26. I was now on Mitchell's inspection staff. And I was engaged on the general inspection of wooden hulls, mainly on the alignment and the assembly of the first metal-constructed hulls and floats, the mole loft, and also covered interchangeability. Now, in 1929, I was selected to become the inspector of the 29 Snyder Trophy Contest S6 machines. and the reconditioning of the S5s that had previously run the Snyder Trophy contest in Italy in 1927. And I was instructed to get 100% direct inspection. I wasn't supervised and I had to do it myself. It was important. This was a new Rolls engine. It was the machine had been constructed by Mitchell round the engine. Previously, for the 1927, it had been the Napier engine, the S5, as it was known, Supermarine, and everything depended upon this race for both our companies, Supermarine and Rolls-Royce, and also the country. The winning of this contest would put our country right on top of the aeronautical world, and so it was important that all these machines receive 100% inspection and finish the day of trials and the course, which they did. I went through all this, the construction, alignment, all the finaling of these machines, submitting stages and what have you to the inspector in charge, AID, because these were Ministry of Supply machines. Up to 1927, it had been a private venture. But in 1927, the ministry came in. They were slow in coming in 29, so we started late. And if I can go on a bit further, in 1931, they refused to come in. When we had the Evan won it twice, had the opportunity of winning it for the third time outright, they refused to come in. And the generosity of Lady Houston, who donated £100,000 that our country should compete, saved the day. And we've got to thank her. Again, in 31 we were late. This was late, the time it had been refused by our government. And Lady Houston made this offer. We had to go full bore to be ready. So, 29, after I'd done that, I'd been engaged on inspections.
Was your job a very popular one in the factory?
Oh, no. An inspector is not very popular with the production side and that. But there's always ways and means of being liked. You could be liked, although you know behind your back you were probably being called certain things. You see, when I went on this Snyder job, I was asked to get 100% inspection, and I was given and told I could forage, not wait for the foreman to put up the stages. He had to do that, but I could still forage in, and if I saw anything, stop it before it went too far, because we were late and we couldn't build something round and got to dismantle it all to put something right. If I could see it, so I foraged around. This got me the name of Eagle Eye amongst the floor, the members of the floor. And I believe that a few of them thought I'd been born out of wedlock, putting it mildly sort of business, you see. And anyway, these 29 machines finished the course. Waghorn won it. There's lots of things I could say what happened. I knew the team, squadron leader Ullibar, Waghorn, flying officer Waghorn, Batchy Ashley, they were flying officers, and there was the lieutenants, D.R.C. Craig, and Stainford. Moon was the engineer officer. There was also a Commander Smith, who acted as liaison between the high-speed flight and the RAF. And, of course, the Rolls-Royce team consisted of Lovesey, who became deputy chief designer of their experimental. He was known as the carburetor expert. He ran the engines. Our responsibility as a submarine was to build the aircraft for the engine to fit. And in some cases, the engine only had an eighth of an inch clearance from the structure. And all the systems up to the engine. But the engine became the Rolls-Royce job. And Lovesey ran it in the dark. So it was open exhaust. So we had a mixture control alongside the throttle. So we could pinpoint the flame down to his requirements.
The exhaust flame.
The exhaust flame. Open exhaust. And in the night you could see it. And he had to pinpoint them. Well, he knew it. He was an expert. And that was the Snyder Trophy 29. I'd been on the construction of the floats and the fuselage of the 27, the S5s, with the Napier Lion. They'd done a good job, the Napier Lion engines. Then we came onto this Rolls. Then in 31, it was a walkover. Boothman. In 1930, I was on holiday with my wife and children at my native home of Brightlingsea when I had a telegram, would I proceed to Felixstowe again? See, I went to Felixstowe quite a number of times afterwards, after I was out of the service, to pass out the S5 as Flight Lieutenant Boothman, he was then, was taking his first flight in a high-speed aircraft. They built them up. They went in seaplanes and come up, and then in the S5 and then the S6, you see. So I went down, and it said on the telegram, it was followed up by a letter, that AID will be down on Wednesday. So I was down there on Monday. I'd done all my inspections. Everything was waiting for me. The AID arrived, and he flew it. He made rather a bumpy landing, but that was his first flight, Flight Lieutenant Boothman, in a seaplane, an S5. That was in 1930 at Felixstowe. And then in 31, I was responsible for the loft, construction of the floats, fuselages, the recondition of the 1929 S6s, which automatically, after they were stiffened to take the higher horsepower, became S6As, and the 1931 were S6Bs. Okay? And I done the reconditioning of those two from 29, the construction of the floats and the cells, and then my colleague and chum took over the final. It was going to be a walkover, no Italian entries. They scratched at the last minute. We were hoping for them and all that. And Pat Maloney, a colleague of mine, he turned on the finals, and I then went on to other flying boats and what have you.
Was Mitchell, was he ill at the time? Was he a sort of man in a hurry to get his...
He was not a man in a hurry. He was a man, shall I say. In other words, I always looked at Mitchell like the hub of a wheel, say a wagon wheel. He was the hub. He was a man who would admit that he didn't do everything himself, but he held men to him. At the end of each spoke was a good man. You know, they were attracted, in my idea, to Mitchell. And he could hold them. And he'd listen to them. And he was not orthodox in many of his ways, you see. If he saw something, he'd take a chance with it. I mean, when we put the petrols in the floats, certain of the orthodox people said immediately, oh, well, if you hit a bit of debris, there goes your petrol. We never hit any debris, but if we had the tank in the float, which was part of the float, not a tank put in the float, it was part of the shape of the float and all that, It was strong enough to withstand anything you would normally that you would get, a balk of timber or something like that. And then when it come to fitting radiators on the wings, the skin of the wings, people have been used to putting radiators under the wings, causing drag and what have you, you say. He took the chance. So the wing skin was two layers of duralumin, or whatever the material was, I think it was duralumin, and fastened with eyelets, keeping them apart, these two skins, about a 32 or something like that, 32 to a 16th, on the top, on the bottom, with a trough each end, where it was pumped, the water pumped along the leading edge and then flowed. The underside of the wing was the same and flowed into a trough and then back, you see, back via the normal course to the engine.